Yui, sawing back and forth in her hand. Turtle comes to an old roadbed lined with Oregon grape, cluttered with fallen leaves. She stands looking down into the Albion River Basin. The sun has risen a hand's breadth above the horizon, crowning the eastern hills, sheaves of light slanting through the stunted trees. The road winds out below her, following a ridge with thickly wooded gulches on either side. She eases along, stopping to watch the silk-lined burrows of spiders in the cut bank, raking through grass for the grass-colored mantises, turning over roadside stones. She has an image of Martin in the kitchen, cooking up pancakes for a Saturday morning breakfast, humming to himself, and expecting her to come down any minute. Her heart breaks at this thought. He will be riddling over what to do as her pancakes get cold, and he will stand at the bottom of the stairs and call up, "Kibble, you up?" She thinks that he will go upstairs and open her door, look at her empty room, scraping his stubble with the edge of his thumb, and then he will go back downstairs and look at all the plates and pancakes and warm raspberry jam he'd set out. The morning turns to early afternoon, blue, cottony, flat-bottomed clouds towing shadows across the forested slopes. At a barren clay promontory, the road makes a turn and descends into the easternmost of two gulches. And here, a clay pullout overlooks the valley. Long, dried ruts. An old VW bus with its tires rotting into the ground. Cyanthus growing up against the driver's side quarter panel. Turtle lays the rabbit across the dirt and opens the van's rusted door and finds it stuffed with oriental rugs. She drags out a rug, unrolls it, and finds nothing but sow bugs and wolf spiders. She walks to the front of the van. She opens the passenger side door and sits inside, looks carefully around the front of the van. There is a strange intermittent squeaking. It sounds like a loose spring in the upholstery, but it isn't that. She opens the glove box and finds decaying maps and something long rotten. She leans down and walks her fingers along the footwell where the moldy upholstery has wrinkled up from the frame. She draws her grandpa's Bowie knife, cuts through the carpet, and pulls it aside. There are three pink newborn mice, the size of her fingertips, laid up along a mounded fold in the carpet, eyes closed, paws folded in small fists, squeaking furiously. Turtle lays the carpet back over the mice. She climbs out of the bus and walks to where the rabbit lays on the dirt. She collars its feet, slits it from anus to throat, pulls its fur off like a bloody sock, and pitches the pelt into the brush. She scoops out the guts and pitches those after the pelt. Then she makes a fire of dry grass and dead wood, skewers the rabbit, and roasts it over the fire, looking by turns at the fire and out at the valley. A mouse comes out from the undercarriage of the VW, and she watches it wander about. It clambers awkwardly up a shoot of grass to get at the seeds in their papery chaff, bowing the sprig over. It extends its muzzle, sniffing and finally opening its mouth to show the chisel of its teeth. Its ears are small and round, and the sun shows pink through them with just a single, snaky pink vein at the center of each ear, catching the light. Turtle takes the rabbit down from the skewer, and the mouse bolts, feinting right and then changing directions in a desperate bid for a nearby rock. But whatever hiding place it expects isn't there, and it performs a panicked circuit of the rock. In a last-ditch effort, the mouse squashes itself up against the rock and waits, panting. Turtle prizes ribs off the rabbit's spine and chews the flesh from them, letting the juice run down her scabby fingers. In time, the mouse comes back and wanders the clay promontory, lifting one tiny hand to lean on this or that stalk of grass, flouncing its whiskers when it sniffs. Turtle finishes the carcass and pitches it over the ledge into the trees below. Her fire smolders. She sits, hands folded, watching. She needs to get up and go home. She knows it, but she just doesn't go. She wants to wait out here, on this clay promontory above the river valley, and wants to watch the day go by. She needs time to sit and go through her thoughts like going through a colander of snow peas. It's not like Martin does, when he paces thinking and thinking, and sometimes gesturing to himself as he tries to think out something difficult. The day warms, turns to late afternoon, and still Turtle does not go, does not move. Then she sees a spider. It is the silvery color of sun-bleached driftwood. It sits sullen at the edge of its hole, eyes hidden behind a mess of hairy legs. The legs unfold and reach carefully out of the cave like ghastly, creeping fingers. She can see no eyes and no face, only the clutch of fingers. It has a speculative creep. The mouse crouches several feet away, hunched over another seed pod, its pot belly pooched up between its legs. When it is done with its seed, it looks down and gives the short hairs on its pink belly a hard look, then riffles through them with its fingers in a sudden, urgent little search, and dives its muzzle into its belly and chews intently for a moment. The spider moves carefully. Stricken, Turtle watches it circle the tuft of grass, drawing closer. She hears then a noise from down the road. Someone walking along the roadbed, and she thinks wildly of Martin. It is more than possible that he has managed to follow her. He has done it before. It is even likely. She rises slowly, silently, drawing the pistol from its holster and slivering back the side to see the bright brass in the chamber, her every movement swift and quiet. But then she stops to watch. The spider emerges behind the mouse and crosses the last 6 inches, and then rears and sinks 2 black hooks down into the mouse's shoulder. The mouse jerks spasmodically, one hind leg pedaling through the air. She hears more footsteps, but Turtle is captivated, watching the spider drag the mouse backward to the burrow, where it lodges crosswise against the silky webbed sides. Knuckles in her mouth, Turtle watches the spider come half out again, fangs buried in the mouse's back. It turns the mouse with deft legs and then pulls the mouse down into the dark, the pink tail twitching. She chews her fingers in anguish. The footsteps draw closer, and Turtle ducks into the woods, lies down behind a log. A slender, black-haired boy comes down the road, her age or a little older, 15 or 16, not watching his feet, wearing a backpack and board shorts, an old t-shirt with a single candle and a twist of barbed wire around it. Some word she doesn't know. He stands, surveying the clay promontory, chewing on the water reservoir's bite valve. He isn't much experienced. The board shorts are a bad idea. His trail running shoes are unscuffed, the backpack new. He doesn't know what he's looking at or what he's looking for. His gaze just wanders. He seems delighted. Another boy comes down the road behind him, this one with an old leather and cordura backpack molding apart, a huge blue tarp rolled up and bungee corded to the side. This new boy says, "Dude, dude, check it out, a van." He's holding a spray can of Easy Cheese and piling it onto a Butterfinger. She places her front sight on the can. "Dude, Jacob, he says to the black-haired boy. Dude, Jacob, you want to sleep in that sick, righteous-looking van? He stuffs the Butterfinger into his mouth and chews. His grin is so big that his jaw stands out and shows his chocolate-stained teeth. He's having trouble eating the bar all at once, and it slips partially out of his mouth, so he pushes it back in with a forefinger. Turtle could shoot the can right out of his hand. Jacob smiles and squats down at the coals of Turtle's fire, raking through it with a stick. She's seen both boys before, last year when they were eighth graders and she was a seventh grader. The candy-eating boy is Brett. They must be high school freshmen now, and she doesn't know how they've gotten here, but they must be a long ways lost. She wonders what the black-haired one is thinking. He is hurtful to look at, his face beautiful and unguarded. They must be on some kind of weekend adventure. Their parents dropped them off. They were going to spend one night out here and walk out the next day, something like that. Jacob sets his backpack down and eases a map from the mesh access pocket. He smooths it flat and says, "Well, this cheese," Brett says, holding up the cheese can. Turtle, placing the front sight perfectly on it, is sick. I mean, fucking dank is all. He props his backpack against one of the VW's wheels and lies down, pillowing his head against it, jetting easy cheese into his open mouth from the can. "I know you don't believe, but truth. I mean truth." Jacob, looking by turns at the map and at the valley, says, "Man, we suck at this." Brett says, "Just because it's in a can doesn't mean it's not real cheese, you know? We are extremely, I mean extremely, I don't want to say lost, but I am not entirely sure of where we might actually be." "You're cheese prejudiced is what you are." Jacob lies back on the rug that Turtle unrolled hours ago. He says, "Our powers of navigation astound." He opens his backpack and pulls out a wedge of Jarlsberg and a loaf of focaccia, still in its tote-fet bakery bag. He and Brett pass these items back and forth, lying propped up on their backs, stretched at length on the oriental rug with small powdery gray moths struggling up from the nap. They take bites directly from the wedge of cheese. "Let's camp here. There's no water." "I wish there was a girl here," Brett says wonderingly, looking up at the sky. "We could woo her with our powers of navigation." "If she were blind and had no sense of direction." "That's sick," Brett says. "Sick deceiving a blind girl like that." "I'd date a blind girl," Jacob says, "though not just because she was blind. What I mean is, I don't think it'd matter." "I'd date her just for being blind," Brett says.
"Really?
How's it any different from objectifying her for her intelligence?" "Her intelligence cannot be abstracted from her personality, whereas her blindness is incidental to who she is and can be abstracted," Jacob says. "I.e., she's not a blind chick. She is a chick who is, incidentally, blind." "But," Brett says, "but dude, she's not, like, responsible for her intelligence in any meaningful way. That's shallow, dude." "She isn't responsible for her blindness either," Jacob says, disgusted. "Unless she plucked out her eyes in a fit of rage." "You date a girl who plucked out her eyes in a fit of rage? You know she's feisty. You just know it." That feels like an understatement. "Dude, bring it. I'm all about it." "I bet she has a wicked temper." "Girls have to start spunky, Jacob, or ninth grade grinds it out of them," Turtle lies in the brush. The sight laid first on Brett's forehead, then on Jacob's. And she thinks, what the fuck? What the fuck? They recline on their rug, ripping off strips of fascia. Brett gestures to the view. Gods, he says, but I wish we had some more easy cheese. When they're done, the boys help each other up and trudge bantering along the jeep track into the redwoods. Turtle rises and stands there for a moment, and then slips into the trees after them. The road is hardly better than a stream bed. Gangly brown roots stick out from the cut bank. They walk for hours and climb finally into a clearing with a cottage built from scrap lumber. It is unlit, and the door stands open. Turtle squats behind a burned-out stump, coal black, eaten by fire into a helix laddered by mushrooms, with flat brown tops and bottoms like frogs' throats. It is shading into early evening. Everything is painted in deep green and sumptuous purple. She watches the boys walk out into the clearing. The clouds look like candles that have been burned down to tiered pools of blue wax. Brett says, Dude, what if you go in there and there's just, like, one deformed blind albino child on a rocking chair with a banjo? Jacob says, and he takes us prisoner and makes us read Finnegan's Wake to his peyote plants. Brett says, you can't tell anyone that my mom made us do that. You can't. Jacob says, why Finnegan's Wake, do you think? Why not Ulysses? Actually, why not just read The Odyssey? Or the brothers Karamazov? Because, dude, you read fucked up Russian bullshit to your peyote plants. You're gonna have a bad time. Okay, so to the lighthouse. Or, you know what? People die in subordinate clauses in that book. Maybe D.H. Lawrence? For a passionate, make love to the gamekeeper kind of high. Dude, with your voice, you were like, look at all these books I've read. But with your eyes, you were like, help me. You know what would be good, actually? Harry Potter. Well, I guess we'll never know what's beyond that door, Brett says. We already know, Brett. We do? Adventure, Jacob says. Behind every door lies adventure. Only if by every you mean some, and by adventure you mean sodomical hillbillies. Nah, dude, it could be dangerous. Actually, and in reality, dangerous. It's fine, Jacob says, and goes up the steps and in through the door. Physically perilous, Jacob, Brett calls after him. In an entirely real, entirely not hilarious way. Come on! Turtle follows the edge of the forest around the back of the cottage, slipping through the brush. She thinks, stay calm, stay easy. She steps up onto the creaking back deck and stands looking out into the woods. There are big black coils of irrigation hoses and heaped 50-pound bags of organic fertilizer at the foot of the deck. There are clipped hoses and coupling links lying beside an overturned bucket with a coffee can ashtray. The deck has an outdoor bathroom with a toilet and shower. The drain cut crudely into the redwood boards with a PVC pipe running to a sump hole. There's a PBR can beside the toilet, and when Turtle picks it up, she can hear the tinkling of its carbonation. She sets down the beer and opens the door and steps into a bare kitchen. Now, she is in the back of the house and the boys are in the front, separated from her by a dividing wall and a closed door. She can hear them. Dude, Brett says, I don't like this. You think someone lives here? Dude, obviously someone lives here. They're reading the Wheel of Time. Probably to their peyote plants. That's so epic. Just read them, like, all 13 books, drop a bunch of peyote buttons, and then, like, hold on to your hat. She walks through a kind of living room. There is a work table with hand loppers and garden shears and a copy of the collected essays of Thomas Jefferson. Unopened boxes of hefty garbage bags are stacked beside a 6-foot-tall wooden Kuan Yin, ornately carved. The ceiling is crisscrossed with white cotton clotheslines. She goes into a bedroom with a large 4-poster bed and a dresser with a mason jar of Bud, a stack of Robert Jordan novels, and a copy of Overcome Your Childhood Trauma. She returns to the back door and slams it behind her to startle them, and it works. She hears Brett whisper, "Shit! Shit!" and she can hear Jacob laughing. They scramble out of the house. She looks into the forest with the gun in her hand. The road does not continue beyond the cabin, and the nervous boys take off south, going cross-country down into the river valley. She listens to the silence of the clearing for a long time. Then she follows them. They walk along a high hedge of thimbleberry in a clearing of velvet grass and sweet vernal grass. Turtle goes quietly among the stumps of old trees. She stops at a large concrete circle in the grass, and beside it, the form of a pump covered in a tarp. She can hear the boys, but she isn't listening to them. She thinks, stop and look. She goes in a half crouch, moving swiftly through the high grass, thinking, oh God, for Christ's sakes, you two, stop and look. She sees them ahead, beside a stream at the border of the forest, the stream half overgrown with bracken. She opens her mouth to call to them, but then she sees a man on the far side of the stream, wearing camo pants and a Grateful Dead shirt. A woven hemp necklace with silver wire twining a large amethyst. A lever-action 20-gauge shotgun slung on his back. He's a small man, with a big rotund belly and a bright red face turned to leather with years of sunburn. The tip of his nose is waxy and bulbed, with little red veins standing out of it. He's got a lemon echinacea juice bottle in one hand. Turtle swings the Sig Sauer up and at him, placing the front sight over his temple, thinking, only if I need to. Only if I need to. Hello, boys, he calls out. How you doing today? Brett straightens and looks around to locate the man. Jacob spots him and calls back. We're good, a little lost. How about you? Turtle goes through the weeds, thumbing back the hammer. She thinks, easy does it. Easy and slow, you bitch. And don't fuck this up. Just do this. Every part of this, exactly fucking right. Every moment of this. Do exactly and only what is necessary. But you do it well, and you do it right, you slut. Where are you boys from? The man asks. Well, I'm from 10 Mile, and he's from Compchi, Jacob says. He walks up to the man, holds out his hand. I'm Jacob, this is Brett. They shake, and Jacob says, a pleasure to meet you, friend. Turtle kneels behind a stump, places the sights on the man's temple. All right, the man says, nodding. He takes out a can of grizzly chew, thumps it twice with the ball of his thumb, pinches up a huge dip, and folds it into his lip. You chew? He says. No, Brett says. Only on special occasions, Jacob says. Ah, the man says. Well, don't start. Myself, I'm trying to quit. They put fiberglass in this stuff. Can you believe that? So, boys, you take it from me. If you're going to take it up, and it has its perks, I'll give you that. You pay the extra dollar and go organic, all right? Right, Jacob says. That's solid advice. Organic, that's the way, man says. Not these chemicals. I believe in organic myself. Better yet, just stick with the marijuana. If it weren't for nylon, that's all we'd ever be smoking. Speaking of that, Jacob says, unshouldering his backpack and setting it down, is there any chance we can buy some from you? Well, says the man, turning the can of chew over in his hands. He frowns. It's no worries, Jacob says. We were just looking for something to add to our adventure. I can appreciate that, the man says, nodding. Sometimes you're just looking for a little something to take the edge off all the walking. And it helps bring out the details, doesn't it? You notice things you otherwise just plain wouldn't. That, Jacob says, is exactly what I mean. I can tell, sir, that you are both a poet and a scholar. Well, I'd hate to leave a friend in need, the stranger admits. My man, Jacob says. I can help you out, he says after a hesitation. What the hell? Turtle thinks. She stands in the grass, gun leveled at the man. Jacob passes the man a $20 bill, and the man opens a canvas pouch on his belt and takes out a tea canister. He pulls the cap and dispenses several buds into his hand, passes them to Jacob. Then he takes out a pipe made from a deer's leg bone, with a wooden mouthpiece whittled to the bone flute, a bowl augured out of the jointed end. He begins breaking apart another bud in his fingers and packing it into the end, going on, this stuff now, not like tobacco, which is as addictive as anything, as addictive as heroin and will kill you. Why I ever started smoking tobacco is beyond me. Trying to quit, hence the chew, you understand. Only problem with the marijuana is that when you grow it out here, the fertilizer isn't good for the salmon, even the organic fertilizer, and that gets to me. Looking at ways around it. Also, another thing is that we have rodents, and things come out of the forest to chew on the stalks of the plants, and you have to poison them or put up with them. I put up with them, and that's why you should buy local. Those Mexican growers, those guys don't care. This isn't their home, right? They just lay down rat poison and it's awful. Just awful. Kills the ringtails, the raccoons, the weasels, all those critters. That's why you gotta buy your weed from guys like me. Locals. Supports the economy and it's better for the environment. Where are you headed, by the way? We're just trying to find a place to camp, Jacob says. The man nods, working his fat lip of tobacco. You're all right, boys. You're all right. Well, I'll get you pointed in the right direction. He squints off west. Why fiberglass? Brett asks suddenly. Huh? The man says. What's that? You said they put fiberglass in the tobacco. But why would they do that? Oh, well, the man says. The fiberglass now. It cuts your lips so that the tobacco gets absorbed faster, makes it more addictive. It's the same thing with all of this packaged food they're selling. Don't ever trust a corporation, boys, and especially don't trust a corporation to make the food you eat. This is why I don't have a car, you understand? Can't conscionably have a car. Not when I've been down to South America myself. Lived among jungle tribes in the Amazon and seen the damage the petroleum industry is doing down there. We should all eat a lot more local food, smoke a lot more pot, and drive a lot less as far as I'm concerned. And love one another. I believe that. Community, boys, that's the way. He lights the bone pipe and takes a long draw. He puffs and then hands the pipe to Jacob. They stand nodding and passing the pipe around. "Well," Brett says, "I admire that, but I have to ride the bus to school. No other way to get there." "Me too," Jacob says, "though sometimes I drive. But you've given me something to think about." Turtle doesn't know what to do. She watches, relaxing her finger on the trigger, but she doesn't lower the gun. After a silence broken only by the stranger's sumptuous chewing and by the boys firing the lighter, Brett says, "Do you know where we go next? We're a little turned around." Jacob says, "Our path to glory has been swift and clear, but our destination eludes us." The stranger nods down the gulch. "That way, keeping to the stream," he says, and then turns and nods back the way they came. "Or that way back." "This stream will take us to a road?" The man nods, either agreeing or seconding the question. It isn't clear to Turtle. He says, "There's roads down there." "All right," Jacob says. "Thanks for the advice, man." "Yeah, dude, we appreciate it," Brett says. "Well, off you go," the man says. Brett and Jacob begin down the slope following the stream. The man taps out the pipe, puts it away, turns, and forges back through the bracken. Turtle tracks him with the sig until he is gone. Then she looks south into the gulch. "The plan is a bad one. I should go back," she tells herself. Then she thinks, "What will Martin do? It will go badly for me. But the hell? I am a girl things go badly for." A light rain begins to fall, and Turtle holds out her hands and looks up at the sky. Huge, misshapen towers of clouds. And then the rain begins in earnest, wetting her hair, wetting her shirt. And she thinks, well, we're in for it now. 6. Turtle stands on a fallen log in the pouring rain. 15-20 feet below her, the flickering yellow beam of Brett's flashlight plays across the seamed and shaggy bark of redwoods, sword ferns, thimbleberry, the scaly, fluted trunks of western hemlocks, across the stream swollen high above its banks. She picks her way down to them. Water runnels, tea-colored with tannins, wind down between the knotty fern rhizomes, cutting dollhouse waterfalls, the soil spangled with something golden but not gold, tiny, wafery minerals that circle the tiny catch pools, reflecting what light there is. The flooding washes millipedes out from beneath the logs, some trick of the current sorting dozens of them onto muddy washes so they lay stacked together, nearly all curled up, blue and yellow and glossy black. She thinks, these useless boys, useless. She needs to leave. She needs to go. But they are lost and won't make their way down this hillside without her. Still, finding her way back home is easier said than done. Walking cross-country under a bright moon and a clear pre-dawn sky is something entirely different than finding your way through this cloud-throttled black. It would be hard going. Beside her, Brett says, "I don't know, dude." Jacob says, "Yeah, I don't know either, man." Turtle boosts herself up onto the log and backpedals quietly into the ferns, going on hands and feet just before Brett sees the log and moves to it, leans against it to take some of the weight off his pack. "Keep going?" Jacob shakes his head. But they can't stop here, that much is apparent. The ground is a mess. Turtle thinks, say something. Say something to them. Point the way for them. But she cannot seem to say anything. The only glimmer is the treacherous light of glowworms, nearly the same phosphorescent green as the tritium sights on her Sig Sauer. And she puts her hand on it now, thinking, I am not afraid of these boys. And if I have to make my way in this dark, I will. But she is afraid of them. She knows just from wrapping her hand around the Sig Sauer's comforting grip, that grip that says, no one will ever hurt you. Just from her own willingness to brave this flooded dark alone, she knows that she is afraid of the boys. Jacob hitches his backpack up on his shoulders, and they continue down the hillside, following the stream, which has overrun its narrow trough and flooded the nearby banks so that the boys splish-splash through ankle-deep water. She thinks, I will wait and see if we come to a road. And if we do, I don't need to do anything. They will go one way, and I the other. But if there is no road, then they're going to need me. They descend into a basin where the stream forms a pond before pouring over the edge, the marshy banks thicketed with cattails. The pond is full of chorus frogs, and when Brett pans the pale yellow beam across the water, Turtle can see their hundreds of eyes, the distinct ridged shapes of their heads breaking the surface. Let's strike out that way, Jacob says, and motions west across the side of the drainage, not down it. If we follow this stream, it is going to be too steep. Dude, Brett says, this stream takes us to the road. That's what the guy said. We aren't good at, like, improvising this navigation thing. What possible reason have I ever given you to doubt my navigation? They both laugh, Jacob looking down into the gulch, nodding. All right, bud, all right. You want to go right down this stream? Yeah, Brett says. That's the way he told us. All right, lead. Shh, Brett says, and turns and swings the flashlight almost onto Turtle. She sits embowered in ferns, grinning. You fuck, she thinks, delighted. You fuck! She thinks, what gave me away? She can feel it in her own face. Her pleasure. Her eyes slitted with happiness. She thinks, you fuck. Did you hear me? Did you see me? Some movement? She is delighted with herself. And with him. For almost having seen her. Thinking, ah, easy cheese boy isn't blind after all. Jacob looks at Brett. Brett says, sorry, man, I had this, like, feeling. I don't know. I just had this feeling. What feeling? There's nothing out there, Brett says, panning the flashlight across dripping ferns, across the tangle of cattails, almost over her. You bastard, she thinks, delighted with him. You motherfucking bastard. She is full of joy. They go through the pond with their backpacks held above their heads, crushing their way through cattails. They climb to the muddy edge, with the waterfall pouring down beside them, and the two boys look down into the gulch. Turtle cannot see what they see, but Jacob leans out, says, it looks pretty steep down there, bud. Brett nods. Jacob says, all right. He sheds his backpack and goes down over the lip. Brett passes him the backpacks one at a time, Jacob carefully banking them into the hillside. Then Brett climbs down. They help each other with the bags and then drop out of her sight. When they have gone, Turtle crawls through the water after them. The muck of the pond bottom is knotted with water lily tubers. They are as thick as her arm, their flesh ridged and scaled, textured almost like pine cones not yet sprung. The drifts of algae feel like thick, sodden spider webs. She comes to the pond's edge and climbs out, shedding water and curtains. Below, the gulch is dark except for the blue glow of Jacob's headlamp and the lance of Brett's flashlight. Over the sound of the rain and the torrent of the waterfall, she can hear them calling out to each other, their heads cut above the ferns like rats through water. Brett pauses and looks back in Turtle's direction, and Turtle lowers herself into the weeds. Jacob plays his headlamp through the dark. Brett says, "I swear, I had this bad feeling." She lies perfectly still and looks right back at them. "Like what?" "Something," Brett says. Jacob wades out toward her, moves the headlamp in meticulous search. "There's nothing here," he says. "Just a bad feeling, a spooky feeling." Jacob stands, turns a slow circle, peering into the dark. He looks back at Brett helplessly. Brett says, "If there's nothing there, then there's nothing there." "I don't see anything. I just hope it's not that guy." "It's not that guy. I just hope he's not, like, following us through the dark." The gulch narrows and grows steeper, spanned by fallen redwoods, the banks scarred by mudslides. 20 feet below, it is finally blocked by an impenetrable wall of poison oak. Brett's flashlight grows pale, dim, and then dies. He slaps the light into the palm of his hand, and it glows to life, a sullen filament lit for a moment before it dies again. Turtle waits above, nervous, thinking, "Just do it, Turtle." She thinks, "Nothing for it now." But still, she cannot. She is going to have to get down on hands and knees and beg Daddy's forgiveness. Beg! And maybe then he will let her off. She hears Brett work the cap and dispense D-cell batteries into his hands. He cups them in his palms and blows on them. Jacob says, "If there's a road, we've got to be right on it." "Shit," Brett says. "Oh, shit. There's no alternative. That's a lot of poison oak we'd have to go through. The road's got to be right past it." Brett hunches over the flashlight, whispering to the batteries, "Come on, come on, come on." In the moment of silence, all they can hear is the rain, soft, padding on leaves, and the crackling of the wet soil, the sound of the river. "He said," Brett says, sounding betrayed, "that we just go this way and we'd hit the road." "We must be right on it," Jacob says. "We've got to be right goddamn there." He starts precariously down, clutching at ferns and shoots of poison oak, each step sinking into the mud. Turtle can see that he will never make it down the hillside. And before she can stop herself, before she can hesitate, she rises out of the weeds and steps up onto a log above them and says, "Wait." They both turn and search the dark for her. And then suddenly she is bathed in Jacob's bright LED light, standing among cow parsnips and nettles, conscious of her ugliness, her lean bitch face, and tangles of silt and copper-smelling hair, half turning away to hide the pale oval of her face. For a moment, no one says anything. Then she says, "Are you lost?" Jacob says, "Not so much lost as unmoored from any knowledge of our location." Brett says, "We're lost." Turtle says, "I don't think that's the way." Jacob looks down the gulch. The light pans over the riot of poison oak, the mud, the water sheeting the ground. He says, "I don't know what would make you think that." Brett says, "Are we above a road?" "I don't know," she says. Brett says, "Who are you?" "I'm Turtle." She comes down and stands in front of Jacob, and he reaches out and they shake hands. "Jacob Lerner," he says. "Brett," Brett says, and they shake. Jacob says, What are you doing here? I live near here, she says. So we're near a road? No, she says. I don't think so. Brett looks wonderingly up at the hillside. People live near here? Sure. Jacob looks back at her, and she is blinded with the blue light again. Sorry, he says, angling the light away. Can you lead us down to the river? Turtle looks away into the dark. Brett says, What happened? Is she still there? She's thinking, Jacob says. Did we make her mad? She's speculative. She's still not talking. Okay, she's really speculative. This way, Turtle says, leading them in a muddy traverse along the hillside, looking for a clear place farther out. Holy shit, Brett says. Holy shit, look at her go! Hey, Jacob says. Wait up! Turtle leads them across fallen redwoods and then descends to the river among grand firs on a low, sloping ridge, Jacob's light casting her shadow out ahead of her, the boys crashing behind. The river has flooded its banks, and Turtle comes down into a great tangle of alders hip-deep in water, long whips of stinging nettle bent in the current and swinging like seaweed, submerged skunk cabbages nosing out of the torrent, rafts of dead leaves scummed up against every nook and cranny, eddies circling blackly with huge dollops of foam. Holy shit on a shitty shingle, Brett says and whistles. There's no road, Jacob says. We're fine without it, Turtle says. Maybe you are, Brett says. Jacob stands there, sheathed to the waist in mud, and laughs and says, Man, drawing it out into a long syllable, his voice giving it somehow a richness of humor and a depth of optimism that she is unused to, running his tongue along muddied lips with pleasure and saying again, Oh, man. Like he can't believe the incredible good fortune of being so entirely lost beside a river so flooded. And Turtle has never seen anyone confront misfortune this way. Brett says, Oh, man. And he says it differently. And then he says, We are fucked. Turtle looks from one to the other. We are fucked, Brett says. We will never ever get home. We are fucked. Yes, Jacob says in hushed awe, weighting his words with relish. Yes. Brett says, It's ironic because we were fine before. We had the perfect campsite before. But no, we needed water. And look, Jacob says, Hashtag success. Hashtag winning. We need somewhere to hole up, Brett says. Then, to Turtle, Do you know where we are? Is there somewhere we could sleep? It's all mud, isn't it? There's nowhere not covered in mud. It is still raining hard, and everyone, including Turtle, is cold. And there is nowhere level here, not with the river flooded. And to find a campsite, they would need to climb the ridge again. And though Turtle could, she doesn't know about the boys. I'm so cold, Brett says. Dude, so incredibly goddamn cold. It's chilly, Jacob agrees with deep humor, trying to wipe the mud out of his eye sockets. He stands stiffly, in the way of people whose clothes are cold and for whom every movement brings new flesh into contact with gritty wet fabric. He looks at Turtle, and something occurs to him. How did you find us? Just ran into you, she says. The boys look at each other, shrug, as if to indicate they've heard stranger things. Can you help us? Brett asks. He hunches, shivering under his backpack. Rain sleets around him. Jacob finds a poison oak leaf stuck to his cheek, flings it disgustedly away into the dark. Turtle chews her fingers in consideration. Jesus, Brett says. You don't feel any urgent need to fill the gaps in conversation, do you? What does that mean? Turtle says. Nothing, Brett says. You seem very patient, Jacob says. You move at your own pace, Brett says. Speculative, Jacob says. Speculative, that's right. Thoughtful, Brett agrees. Like, where did you study Zen Buddhism? And was your Zen master the ancient, slow-moving reptile in whose shell rests the entire universe, known and unknown, fathomed and unfathomed? Is that what your name means? Is this a koan? Can you help us? To which the reply is, and can only ever be, silence. Dark, dude. Turtle is surprised that they would go on like this in a cold downpour, and then she thinks, they're waiting on you, Turtle. They're waiting on you, and the talking helps them. This way, she says, and leads them back into the forest. In the dark, she circles the largest trees, Jacob shining his light on them. She leaves the boys huddled together and ventures out in every direction, cutting back to them when she doesn't find what she's looking for. She is hoping for a burned-out redwood with a hollow chamber, but the best she finds is a stump, cross-cut long ago, with axe notches in the sides where the scaffold was pegged to the trunk. She looks up at the stump's hidden crown, and Jacob watches her, shading his eyes from the rain, and then follows her gaze. Lightning strikes on Albion Ridge across the river, and Turtle counts it, 2 miles before the thunder comes, rolling with the distance. She climbs up the bark, hooks the top with a long reach, and drops into a deep, circular pit where the heartwood has rotted out. The hollow crown is 10 feet across and tall enough to sit in without being able to see over the sides. A single huckleberry grows up through the middle in a rough circle of punky wood that drains the water. She wraps her fist around its base and rips it out and pitches it into the dark. She helps Brett and Jacob up, and they begin digging out leaf litter. She opens Brett's backpack, finds 100 feet of parachute cord, still in its tight store-bought bundle, teases the bundle apart, quarters the line, and passes her knife through the loops to make 4 25-foot lengths. They unfold the blue tarp, and Turtle bowlines the parachute cord to the corner grommets. Then she drops off the stump, and Jacob after her, while Brett holds the tarp. She pitches Brett a center pole, and he holds it in place. She wraps the first line around the stob, passes the bitter end to the standing line, and ties a taut line hitch, a sliding grip knot that can be cinched up the wet line, though she wonders, even as she is tying it, if a tarbuck knot would be better. She guys out each line in turn. When she comes to the last, she finds that Jacob has already guided out and tied it to the taut line hitch. Water runs down the line, gathers just above the knot, and streams off in a single ribbon. The blue light from the headlamp follows the water on the parachute cord. She runs the knot between thumb and forefinger, binds it tight and well-dressed. Jacob stands beside her. She says, "You knew this knot already?" "No," he says, "just saw you make it." She plucks the line, and it thrums. She looks at him, but doesn't know what to say, because he'd made the knot well, in the dark, not knowing how to make it. And she thinks he should be told how good that is, how rare. But she doesn't know how to say such a thing. She undoes Jacob's knot, then makes the next knot with conspicuous slowness. She ties a slip knot high on the standing line. She takes the bitter end, which passes around a branch, and brings it through the slip knot and bends it back down, making a pulley. She hauls on the line until the cord cuts paling corrugations across her palms. The pulley tightens the whole system. The tarp creaks with strain. She looks at him again. Rain runs down his face, and he wipes his eyes, nodding. She ties the tension off with half hitches, making them with exaggerated slowness. She glances back at him again and plucks the cord. "Ah," he says. "The rain," she says, "loosens the lines." He nods again. Here is the difference between me and Martin, she thinks. Here is the difference. It is that I know the rain loosens the lines and I care. And Martin knows that the rain loosens the lines and he does not care. And I do not know why. I do not understand how you could not care, because it is important to do things right. And if that isn't true, I don't know what is. She circles the stump, testing each guy line, cinching them down and doubling them up with half hitches, thinking, God damn, Martin, and how I will pay for this. How I will get down on my knees and beg not to pay, and how I will pay anyway. It's like she can see in the dark, Brett says. She can, Jacob says. You can tell she can. No, like she can really see in the dark, and not just a little. Yeah, Jacob says. That's what I mean. Where do you think she is right now? In her head, Jacob says. I can hear you, Turtle says. She climbs up the side of the stump and helps Jacob after her. She's so quiet. Not all of us, Jacob says, go through life in a caffeine-fueled rage, Brett. Hey, Brett says, it's good for your stomach. The coffee burns the ulcers right off your stomach lining. What are you talking about? Turtle says. Coffee, Jacob says, and how it mineralizes your bones. Is that true? No, Jacob says. Inside, they have made a kind of dark, wet grotto, 10 feet across, maybe 4 feet deep. Brett has laid down a heavy-duty plastic ground cloth, and now he hunches at the far end of the grotto, huddled up in a sleeping bag, his arms wrapped around himself, shivering. Jacob is unpacking his bag. He takes out a siliconized nylon stuff sack and offers it to her. What? She says. Take my sleeping bag. No way. You're shivering. So are you, she says. I'm going to spoon Brett, he says. Brett says, what? Take the bag, Jacob says. No, she says. First of all, we owe you, Jacob says. We never would have found somewhere dry if not for you. Second of all, Marcus Aurelius says, Brett groans. If only, he says, the Emperor's journal had been burned, as he asked. Should we really follow the instructions of a man whose final instruction was that his former instructions be destroyed? Marcus Aurelius says, Jacob continues, that joy for humans lies in human actions, kindness to others, contempt of the senses, the interrogation of appearances, observation of nature and of events in nature. This, loaning you my bag, satisfies all of those conditions. Please take it. Turtle is looking at him, incredulous. What's happening? Brett says. I don't know, Jacob says. Maybe she's making an expression? What? Turtle says. Please let me give you the bag. No. Brett says, Turtle, take the bag. Seriously. His grasp of reality is tenuous at best, so arguing with him is dangerous. Nobody knows what will shake off that last handhold and send him spiraling into madness. Also, I have a sleeping bag that we can sort of spread out like a blanket. Turtle looks from one to the other of the boys, and tentatively accepts the sleeping bag and begins pulling it out of its sack. The nylon is such a high grade that it is soft as silk. It is homemade and has no zipper. She slips into it. The rain drums on the plastic ceiling, filling